Our fundamentals need to be solid in good times so that when we take a look at innovation and how do things like this impact innovation for us, generally when there's choppy waters is when we double down.
You're tuning in to the InsureBreak podcast. It's the podcast about the latest and greatest trends in insurance. I'm your host, Ash, and I invite you to join us as we interview experts and executives in insurance covering innovative practices, technology advancements, and insight into the future of insurance. This podcast is sponsored by Zelros. Zelros is an AI software solution for insurance to hyper-personalize the customer buying experience with insurance recommendations across all channels, boosting client acquisitions, cross-sell, and upsell.
He is CFO and Canada's Managing Director at Intact Ventures, a part of Intact Financial Corporation, Canada's largest home, auto, and business insurer. Over his 21-year career at Intact, Kareem has held leadership roles in distribution, finance, corporate research, and development. He launched Intact Ventures in 2016, which invests in startups that will disrupt the property and casualty industry long-term, and has deployed over $300 million in capital across 30 investments globally. He also moved to Hong Kong in 2019, where he spent 2 years launching Intact's first international location for their artificial intelligence lab. Upon returning to Canada in 2021, he assumed the leadership of finance function across Canada in addition to leading ventures. Kareem, it's exciting to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ash. Nice to be here.
So to get started, can you take us back a little bit? Where did you begin your career?
Actually, coming out of university as a finance grad way back in 1999, I actually said to myself, I don't want to work in finance, ironically enough. And fast forward over 20 years and I'm the CFO, but...
Why did you not want to work in finance?
So I had even though I enjoyed the analytical side and, what I was doing at school, I had a preconceived notion, I guess, of what finance was. And I didn't want to work or be a banker and just work behind a computer and spreadsheets all day, which was my impression of finance at that point. I wanted to have something that was a bit more varied, where I could tap into my social skills, where I could build relationships, where I could... use the analytical side, but also have something a bit more well-rounded. So I saw a position posted for an underwriter trainee at an insurance company. I had absolutely no idea what an underwriter trainee did, but I applied for that. I interviewed with a gentleman there who actually became my best friend 20 years later.
So you started as an underwriter?
Started as an underwriter. That's where my heart is, underwriting.
Nice. So what is obviously we know your current role as CFO, but what do you do right now at Intact? What are your responsibilities? What's your day-to-day like?
After the RSA acquisition that we made last year, we now have global operations. Canada represents about 70% of our business globally, but we do have operations as well in the UK and Ireland, as well as in the United States. But because Canada is such a big part of our overall business, $20 billion, in direct written premiums, 14,000 employees. My role really from a day-to-day basis is to run the finance function as the CFO across Canada. We do have multiple brands, multiple distribution units, lots happening in the Canadian marketplace. So really the finance role gives me an opportunity to wake up every day and try to figure out where I want to get my hands dirty and where I want to poke around a little bit and see how I can help move the operations forward. I also manage Intact Ventures, which is our venture capital division.
Very nice. So you're not working on spreadsheets?
I'm still working on spreadsheets, though. I haven't been able to get away from that. I was probably one of the few people at Intact that had a lot of relationships externally, right? Most of our people are focused internally in terms of making our operations thrive every day. But, we're a pretty forward-thinking organization. And our CEO asked me back in 2018 to do a bit of work on what was happening in AI. Because we're a data-driven company that really measures ourselves in terms of outperformance from both an ROE as well as a combined ratio perspective, we've always believed in the power of data. We have over 200 AI experts in Canada, and we've been very fortunate to be close to where we feel a lot of the cutting-edge research has happened over the last generation in Montreal and Toronto with respect to deep learning and the good work that Jeffrey Hinton's done at the University of Toronto, et cetera. But if you look at the next 20, 30, 50 years, it's probably a safe bet to say that there's some interesting things that are happening in China, particularly with the consumer adoption, the digital transformation, the availability of data, and the Chinese government's real belief that data and AI is going to be a core competency that they want to develop. And you see the amount of capital that's been flooded in that area as well. So, you know, my recommendation looking at AI globally at that point was, let's invest some resources to be closer to where we think that cutting edge research may happen. Because it's our customers' data, I was uncomfortable with locating in mainland China due to data and IP issues that I thought we may face. But Hong Kong felt like a very good alternative, close to China, still had the British rule of law, four out of the top 100 universities globally. So I made that recommendation and my CEO said, well, that's great. If that's the recommendation, why don't you go do it? My wife and I moved to Hong Kong and it was always thought to be roughly a two-year assignment. Go there, get it up and running, and then return back to Canada. And at that time, I knew we were working on the RSA transaction. So as soon as it got announced, I knew that was probably going to get accelerated by a few months because they needed some help back home.
Nice. Yeah. And this is a little bit of a tangent. I'd be curious to hear, you know, AI as a tool. What do you feel like AI as an application to insurance? Like, where have you seen AI as an application to insurance be like super useful or like, oh, wow, this is a super great application of AI in the insurance space?
The development and the value that we've seen with AI at Intact, first of all, has been really robust, really interesting. It's made us want to increase our investment even faster than what we're currently doing. But I think we've only touched the surface, Ash. Like, for example, because we are so focused on outperformance and making sure that we utilize our size and our scale and our data set, a lot of our early use cases with respect to AI was around incorporating machine learning and pricing. So we were the first insurer in Canada and likely one of the first in North America that incorporated machine learning in our personal auto insurance pricing. So that we had, you know, billions of data nodes when we're actually trying to personalize pricing on an individual basis. And when you take a look at use cases that improve loss ratios, even by half a point or 1 point, you know, when you're a $20 billion Canadian company, you know, every half a point brings a pretty big use case in terms of where the value is. So I would say a lot of our early work on the AI side over the last 5 to 6 years has been focused around pricing, modernizing our pricing systems, and really trying to gain an edge in terms of segmentation. The first big data problem that we actually embarked on was when we introduced telematics a handful of years ago as well. And today, many companies have telematic programs, but you know, 5 or 6 years ago, we were one of the first to actually introduce that. And we were definitely the only one that had a high penetration rate where over 50% of our customers on a new business perspective were actually voluntarily opting in. So again, how do you incorporate machine learning and AI when you're taking a look at new data modes and trying to influence pricing for these customers on an individual basis? So the pricing aspects are great. We've seen the value, but now we're also trying to look at the use cases outside of pricing. So for example, in claims, and we'll talk about, I'm sure, you know, what's happening in the economy today, but the quicker that you can actually determine that a car is a total loss or not, which seems simple, but you actually need some pretty good analytical insights and AI to be able to make that prediction, the much sooner you can actually reduce cycle time, improve the customer experience, and save on costs in that process. On the sales side, we've got relationships with 1 in 4 Canadians across the country. So how do you take the information that you have in terms of previous customer interactions, their propensity to buy or renew, their number of products, their profitability, and when that customer actually calls into our call center, use that intelligence to be able to predict who should be the right agent based on our agent profiles to answer that call? And you know, there's dozens and dozens of use cases like this, Ash, and we're just at the onset, I think, in terms of what's going to be a very exciting generation of developments, both in terms of pricing, customer experience, and cost efficiency in terms of how AI can assist.
Wow. So you're saying you have, so Canada's population is what, like 38, 39, 40 million. So you guys have almost 10 million customers in Canada?
We have relationships with 1 in 4. So yeah, our market share in Canada is about 20%. We're about 2.5 times larger than the second largest insurer. We're number one in car. We're number one in home. We're number one in business. Mm-hmm. And we're number one in every province that we operate in.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow. Okay, well, just kind of back onto the topic of the economic climate. So what impact do you see in insurance business in terms of like what areas do you feel like are affected the most? Obviously, we're kind of in a recession already because it's been going down for the past 6 months. Technically, we are in a recession.
Look, the Canadian and U.S. economies are linked in a lot of respects, but they're also unique a little bit in other ways as well. You know, in Canada, the relationship between the government and the Bank of Canada, which really sets our monetary policy, has been tightly linked over the last 30 years and has been quite successful in terms of managing inflation between a range of 1% to 3% quite well, which has allowed, I think, Canada to really thrive from a global perspective and a G7 perspective. Over the last 25 years as well. The problem that we have today, on the Canadian side is we kind of benefit in terms of our natural resources since we are such a big, oil producer. So when you see inflation kind of build up in that area as well, Canada as a country will flourish and really help with that. But we also look at then the impact on what that could mean for our business and for our stakeholders as well. And the first thing that we try to think about when we talk about the new economic climate, whether that's a recession, whether that's stagflation or where you kind of sit on that path, is, are these changes really structural or is it temporary? And it's very, very important to try to make that distinction as you look at the different aspects, because the reaction that we take as an insurer has to be aligned with that. And you don't want to overreact or underreact. We saw last week what happened in the UK with one of the insurers there that talked about, the pressures on inflation in their book of business. And I think their stock went down 40% overnight, and other UK insurers suffered alongside it. To me, the things that I worry about or that I think about actively with the new economy, I guess first would be high inflation. That would be the obvious area. What's the impact from a cost of goods perspective? What's happening from a geopolitical perspective and the conflict in Russia and Ukraine over time with respect to oil prices, gas prices, et cetera? And how long will this actually last with respect to supply chain disruption? I think for us, what we've seen on the insurance business side is we've seen some of the inflation creep up a little bit on the short tail physical damage type claims. But insurance is also, P&C insurance is quite fortunate because we can reprice contracts on an annual basis. So we've been pretty bullish in terms of making sure that from a rate perspective and a segmentation perspective, we're keeping up on the trends from a short tail perspective in order to keep that under control. We really haven't seen any hints of inflation yet on the long tail side, which is quite quite good in terms of, where our book of business is. From a structural perspective as well, I mentioned supply chain, and we shouldn't overlook that. We've been investing heavily in our supply chain, particularly on the claim side, for the last generation. And, we did things like acquire a restoration company called Onside, mainly from a customer experience play. But when we take a look at our relationships with third parties, with contractors, et cetera, we're in a fortunate position in Canada to have deeper relationships within our supply chain in order to be able to manage costs and to use our size and scale to drive efficiencies as well. Similarly, on the auto insurance side, where we've got preferred body shops across the country, we do things like buy paint, for the body shops, et cetera. So again, our size and scale really allows us to be ahead of the curve in terms of managing the inflationary pressures. I think maybe just on a slightly different path, when you think about the economic climate, is the whole notion of climate and, what's happening from a climate perspective, and you see a big movement, globally in terms of equity and capital rushing to these areas and trying to find solutions to either meet the Paris Agreement or to meet the commitments that private corporations are putting forth. And it's a bit disappointing what we saw south of the border last week in terms of the climate agreements not actually passing and going through. But I think regardless of that, you're still seeing states and private corporations decide to still uphold their promises and try to move forward. And similarly, here in Canada, we've got a government, we've got a private community, and we've got Intact as well that are looking to meet our climate objectives over time. So, how does that new economic reality over the medium term, develop? How do we move from a world of, carbon credits to actually looking at actual reduction technology that will result in, you know, net zero initiatives as well? And how does Intact play a role in helping facilitate that, both as a leading insurer in Canada, both as a good corporate citizen and where our employees want us to play? And also on my side, how can ventures help play a role in that path too, as we try to spur innovation and progress in this? So for me, at least from an economic perspective, I think that's where my head is at today.
So now if we can kind of flip the question, what advice would you give families in terms of their finances as it relates to insurance?
I'll speak firstly from my own personal experience and the conversations I've had with my financial advisors as well. First of all, patience is important. In my history, trying to time markets hasn't necessarily led my investment portfolio to be in a better place. So I think, you know, as long as you're not approaching retirement and you have a longer term horizon, being a bit patient, I think, is important in times like this. The message that the government's been sending as well is very much aligned with how I feel personally, where we need to make sure, again, when we're talking about what's structural and what's temporary, that businesses and individuals don't get into the mindset that inflation's here to stay. Because as soon as we enter into that mindset that inflation's here to stay, we're going to start arbitrarily raising prices across the board in areas that are not impacted by supply chain or other areas. And then you're just going to see a vicious cycle of that leading to higher wages leading to higher demand leading to more inflation. So I'm very positive in the sense that the Bank of Canada has actually chosen to aggressively start moving on interest rates. And I think as individuals, you know, look at the choices that we're making every day. There's adjustments I think that we all are making in terms of, are we taking more road trips this summer or not? Based on the price of gas, personally, I'm not driving out there as much. Is that going to accelerate things like, you know, hybrid or other technology out there that isn't as dependent on fuel? And I think, you know, the hybrid world as well that we're all living in, from a fortunate perspective, it has caused a lot of individuals and families to actually save money over the last 2 or 3 years as well, which is causing some of the pent-up demand as well. So as interest rates rise, hopefully more of that savings will be put into savings as opposed to spending today. And families will be in a better position to withstand some of the noise that I think we're feeling, you know, for the next 6 or 12 months. But fortunately, they don't have to commute to work as much because it's a hybrid world. They're not spending as much money on clothes and lunches. So hopefully over the short term, they'll be able to withstand this and we'll be in a better place in the medium term.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, if I'm thinking about innovation, right? How does like this, you know, economic climate, you know, you mentioned climate change, you mentioned supply chain, you mentioned all these things. How do all these things, how does that impact innovation in the insurance space, do you think?
I can only speak for Intact, Ash. And if you look at our history and our track record, right, we've grown quite a bit through acquisition over the last 10 or 15 years. Our ROE compared to the industry over the last 10 or 12 years, I think we've outperformed the industry by 640 basis points. The track record of outperformance is there. Investors give us a very high price to book multiple, which allows us to go out and invest. The reason why I mentioned this in answering your question is our fundamentals need to be solid in good times so that when we take a look at innovation and how do things like this impact innovation for us, generally when there's choppy waters is when we double down. And when you look at our track record, that's really where we invest and we reinvest and we acquire. And you see our margins compared to the industry actually expand as others are trying to figure out the short-term impacts of things that perhaps weren't as tightly controlled as what we do at Intact. So, you know, the story for me, as I think about our, you know, planning as we're doing right now for 2023, is double down on digital, double down on data and AI, and continue focusing on ventures and launch our third fund and also look at potentially where we can assist on deploying capital to help the climate side on the venture piece as well. You know, we're digitally engaging 3 out of 4 of our customers. We want to make sure that we use data and we use our, you know, risk insights and abilities to help improve the customer experience. And we want to make sure that we're helping our broker partners, you know, become more efficient and be able to communicate with their customers more directly as well. So for us, we continue looking at efficiencies internally and then redeploying that capital back into improving the customer experience, improving digital and data over time. So at Intact, I think you're going to see innovation continue to increase at a pretty good clip over the next 12 to 18 months.
Wow. So you're saying that when there's a recession or when the economic climate is declining, you double down. When you increase spending, obviously, that means you're kind of increasing your risk a little bit. Would you say that like you're okay with taking more risk during a recession?
So I didn't say increase spending. When we bought RSA 12 months ago, we committed to the street that we would generate $250 million in synergies over the next 3 years. So again, we can utilize our size and scale in order to improve our expense base as we grow our business. Now, what do we do with the money that we're saving, for example, in this RSA side? Some of that for sure will result in a net lower expense ratio, but we may choose to reinvest some of that in other parts of the business to help our transformation as well. So from a dollar-to-dollar perspective, you know, there might not be an increased dollar spend compared to what our expense base was year over year, but the efficiencies that we generate in our operations, and by focusing on other areas, we try to redeploy some of that capital back into areas that we want to increase spend. For example, you know, one of the areas that I'm thinking about this year is real estate. Real estate is, you know, one of our largest spends on our side. We have over 250 locations across Canada now, and we're trying to rethink what our new hybrid footprint will be. We want employees back in the office for sure, but do we need the same 100% of the real estate that we had pre-COVID? Likely not. So let me go generate $10, $20, $30 million in savings on real estate. Maybe half of that I keep, but the other half, maybe let me redeploy in technology, for example.
I see. That's a subtle distinction. Okay. So then like, how are you preparing, you know, your business, you know, kind of thinking now long-term, like, you know, 5 years, 6 years, hopefully, you know, it's not a depression, obviously. So what are you doing to prepare coming out of a recession?
The obvious first area is, luckily, P&C insurance is generally recession-proof. Like, let's start there. In the sense that on the demand side, people always need to insure their homes, they always need to insure their cars, and they need to insure their businesses. So for the most part, we're a pretty safe investment from an investor perspective in times like this as well, because our top line is pretty stable. The risk, again, on the insurance side is more so, can you price the risk, see the trends, and react accordingly? But I think, again, as I mentioned, our data-driven methodology gives me a lot of comfort in terms of knowing that we have a good track record on that side. So the risks or the things that I try to keep top of mind and preparing the business is making sure that even though we are so focused on data, that we have the right control mechanisms in place to monitor the quality in underwriting, to look at the emerging trends in claims, to look at what's happening in the external environment, and to make sure that we're properly pricing for that and changing our risk selection so that we come out of more difficult times like the recession in a profitable state so we can continue investing in areas. Managing supply chain, again, we've done good work on that over the last 20 years. Through times like this, we take a look at where can we even gain more control on supply chain? What are some areas that we're seeing today that perhaps we need to improve our relationships, improve our contracts, or potentially even deploy capital to control more of that supply chain is something that we actively think about. You know, starting in terms of our basic philosophy, we always make sure that our balance sheet is in a healthy position. So, you know, when we're out there looking to acquire, we're making sure that the deals that we make are accretive over a 3-year period of time. That is actually ROE positive in terms of the generation of what we have so that we can increase our performance, and that we roughly have a debt to equity ratio of about 20%. And we generally don't go above that level. So again, in times like this, we're not really faced with having a balance sheet that's at risk. We have an extremely strong balance sheet to be able to withstand the issues that we're facing over the next 12 to 18 months and come out stronger on the other end. And then I think the expense management piece that I touched on a little bit, you know, we don't wait for hard times to start managing expenses. We're actively managing expenses throughout the entire process to deliver a low expense ratio due to our scale advantages, and then decide where to reinvest that in terms of digital data and the employee experience. So those are things, again, that are always top of mind, but in times like this are even more so top of mind to make sure that the business thrives in the environment that we're in.
So if I'm looking at a pie chart of like, you know, your investments, like the portfolio, what percentage is in each category?
In terms of what categories, Ash?
In terms of, like, let's say 30% of our investments are focused on AI, you know, 30% of our investments are focused on supply chain, or I don't know, maybe there's a mix of, just out of curiosity, what's the kind of...
I don't have the specific numbers in terms of how you're looking at it, but let me answer the question slightly differently. So we try to outperform the industry from 500 basis points on an annual basis is kind of our target. And where do we generate that outperformance from? So when we take a look at our business, we believe that about 300 basis points comes from data and underwriting. About 300 basis points comes from supply chain. And about 200 basis points comes from investment management and how we manage our own portfolio of investments. So you're going to tell me, you know, 300 plus 300 plus 200 doesn't equal 500. That's intentional because, you know, even though we try to outperform by 500, we take that 800 points of outperformance and we reinvest 300 points of that into digital and data. So that's kind of the formula that I talked about earlier, where it's not just about spending more, it's about gaining outperformance and then reinvesting a part of that into our portfolio as well.
So from a venture perspective, you know, putting your venture cap on, have investments changed given the economic climate? And if so, how have they changed?
Our philosophy is a little bit different than other corporate VCs. Because we've got such a great advantage on digital and data, we don't utilize our venture capital dollars as an R&D expense. And what I mean by that is a lot of other firms will try to strike near-term partnerships or near-term proof of concepts with the companies they invest in because it's research and development dollars. Our philosophy on that is we can choose to partner, we can choose to build, and we've got 14,000 people focused on that. Let me make sure that myself and my small venture team are focused on long-term disruption. You know, what are people working on that may have a profound impact on our business 5, 10, 15 years from now? And they may be directly trying to disrupt insurance. You know, they might be looking at part of the supply chain or looking at a part of the value proposition and attacking a part of it, which is great. But most of our investments actually are in companies that aren't waking up thinking about insurance. But if the technology that they develop actually works, it could have a profound impact on pricing, underwriting, risk selection, et cetera. So, and we generally invest in earlier stage businesses, Series A, Series B. So in that context, you know, I think looking at what's happening in the environment today, first, probably a bit of a cooling off on the insurtech side based upon, you know, what we've seen with some of the companies over the last 24, 36 months that have gone public. I could speak firsthand on that. I was a major investor in Metromile down in the US as well. We're no longer investors in that firm. But, you know, we kind of saw, you know, what happened with some of these companies as they went to the public markets. So I think generally there's not as much hype on the insurtech area. But because our companies that we invest in are early stage, they're not normally, you know, later stage companies, we really haven't seen the impact on our portfolio. And in fact, the entry valuations on where we invested in, you know, we feel very, very comfortable with, even in the downturn that we're seeing today. So I think more venture capital firms today are getting more nervous about later stages, particularly on the insurtech area. And you now see more dollars chasing early stage investing. So maybe two takeaways there. The first is there's still a lot of capital and there's still a lot of venture capital that's there. People haven't necessarily pulled back, particularly on the traditional venture area, but they are moving earlier, which makes it more competitive in terms of where we normally like to invest. You're still seeing a lot of competition for the best firms in these areas, which I think is good. I think it's a lot more rational in terms of the companies that are getting funding, and it's less exuberant in terms of what we were seeing 18 to 24 months ago anyway. So having a bit more discipline in that area, you know, is great, and I think the best companies are still able to get funding and able to thrive in the current environment as well.
What technology category do you see investments going?
You know, for us, the four areas that we're currently investing in are mobility. So, you know, how do customers or goods get from point A to point B? You can think about the entire spectrum of autonomous vehicles. You can think about companies that have autonomous trucks that are moving goods from A to B. You know, we've invested in a whole spectrum of mobility type of companies there. We're investing in data and AI, obviously, as a vertical. But quite honestly, that will likely change in our next fund because over the last 5 or 6 years, data and AI just underpins almost every investment that we make. It's no longer, I think, a direct vertical. We're investing in the sharing economy, but not just the sharing of goods. We're also thinking about the sharing of balance sheet and the sharing of risk. So, you know, what are the new models in terms of how risk is shared in the future and how may that impact property and casualty insurers in the future? And then the fourth area is distribution. And we've always believed that the entry point to disruption in our industry will come through distribution. So we're always actively looking at what are the new ways that companies are trying to better meet consumer needs and how does that fit into our wheelhouse in terms of how we think about interacting with consumers and models that we need to build as well. So I think that's where Fund 2 was built a few years back, and we're still deploying capital out of that. But I think as we're starting to think about launching Fund 3 in the next 6 to 9 months, you know, themes that my team and I are debating first would be around, you know, rising acquisition costs. Insurance is one of the most expensive keywords, I think, right now when you're actually bidding on Google, et cetera, and that's not improving at all, at least in Canada. So what are the different ways that, you know, people will try to get access to consumers as they focus on distribution, whether that's embedded, whether that's B2B or other modes of distribution? The second theme is falling consumer sentiment. There's definitely less trust in government. It's questionable on whether there's less trust in businesses or there's just less trust in some businesses. And how does that actually then play a role with respect to consumer expectations of people that participate in the economy? I think the third is mobility and prop tech are still very important and how people engage with their largest purchases and their largest physical assets. Data and governance is another area as well. So how do people think about trust, data security, privacy? And then Web 3.0 and decentralized finance is one that, you know, we always have internal debates on. I think quite honestly, this won't be an investable area for us when we launch the new fund, but it's a trend that we're definitely monitoring and perhaps we change our course on that in 2 or 3 years, but I will not be investing in crypto anytime soon. And then, of course, the last would be climate, but I think we've already touched on that a bit.
I got some Coinbase puts. Do you want to buy them?
Insurance today, look, there's not a lot of barriers to entering into insurance, but it's not exactly easy as well from a balance sheet capital perspective. And if you try to capitalize an insurance company based upon traditional means, it's very difficult because, you know, venture capitalists look for a very strong return on the money invested. Venture capitalists are not looking to invest $100 million into a company, an insurance company, and that insurance company then parking that on its balance sheet in order to have regulatory capital to pay out claims in the future. Like, that's a very poor use of venture capital dollars. If I think about that on a larger scale, like Intact, you know, that has a $30 billion balance sheet, et cetera, how might there be more efficient ways for us and for others to better utilize our capital? And if others figure out different ways of using capital that result in a lower cost of capital, could that potentially be disruptive to us? I think the answer is yes. I don't necessarily know what those new forms may be, but you want to be close enough to that so that if new models develop, then you're there in order to understand, learn from that, and potentially change the way that you manage capital internally as well, so that we are able to maintain our ROE advantage compared to the industry, because obviously the E in ROE is critical in terms of what we're talking about here.
So to kind of wrap it up, we always end off with, you know, what your thoughts are on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the space and in general, and maybe if you have any stories to share.
You know, personally, I have, obviously, we all have our own story. You know, I was fortunate and lucky enough to be born in Canada, and Canada is a fantastic place to call home. And, you know, living in Hong Kong for a couple of years as well, you know, you really learn to appreciate what you left behind as well. You know, my family is a family of immigrants, right? So they were all born in Uganda. I have 5 older sisters, all born 1 year apart. And then there's an 8-year age gap, and then it's myself. So, you know, my 5 sisters and my parents were all born in Uganda. In 1972, if you know a little bit about the story of Uganda, Idi Amin, who was a dictator at that time, came in and gave all of the Asians, you know, 60 days to leave the country, or they were going to face some dire consequences. And, you know, luckily for us, Canada was one of the small handful of countries that sent planes to Uganda to take the refugees out before something bad happened. So, you know, my family ended up in Canada and I was born 4 years later. It's a bit tough because I think at least when I was growing up, Canada was thought of, you know, being a melting pot. And a melting pot to me at that time kind of meant leave behind a little bit what you had or what you were and try to become Canadian. And, you know, how we defined being Canadian was kind of shared values, shared interests, and all kind of being the same. So I think unconsciously growing up, I kind of shied away from some of the cultural differences that made us unique and just try to fit in. And today, it's all about celebrating differences and celebrating individuality and not having to change who you are to be different. And 47 years later or 46 years later, it's great to see that progress in society, but we still have so much work to do. And at Intact, you know, diversity has been top of mind for us for many, many years. And I think the first area that we focused on, because you can't move the needle on everything at the same time, but I think gender representation was the one that we really wanted to focus on. And, you know, the progress that we have now at our board of directors and senior management level, it's phenomenal. And I think we've been great. Like we're there from a 50-50 perspective generally on both of those areas. And I think there's still some more work to do internally, but you see some great progress on the gender diversity side, but we still need to make a lot more progress on visible minorities, on people with disabilities, on LGBTQ. Like it's happening, but it's probably moving slower than what I would like, but that's good. We're all impatient and we all want to see progress tomorrow. To me, the thing that I remember the most, though, sitting in all of these meetings around over the last 10 years, I remember an individual coming to me or talking to us at a senior management table and saying, you know, diversity is about being invited to the dance and inclusion's about being invited to dance. Until that point, I honestly don't think I quite understood what the difference between diversity and inclusion is. And in that moment, I was like, holy crap, like this isn't just about 50-50 or, you know, getting people there. That's half the battle. The harder part is making sure that people actually feel included to be their own selves and not having to feel like they have to fit into the Intact melting pot.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never thought about the difference between, you know, being included versus being invited. Thanks for sharing that. So to end it off, we ask, you know, if you could go back and talk to the 20 years and talk to the younger Kareem, what would you tell him? What would you tell yourself?
I am a firm believer in the sum of the parts, including all of the mistakes that we've made, and I've made a ton of mistakes, kind of have resulted in who you are. So I don't believe in rewriting history, but knowing who I am, remembering that patience is key and just stopping every once in a while. And slowing down, I think I definitely would be advising my younger self. I'm always focused on the next challenge, right? Like great things happen, but I don't stop enough to celebrate success. And I just move on to the next thing because I don't know, that's just kind of how I'm wired. And quite honestly, I've kind of found myself in an organization that's wired in the same way. Pausing, stopping, celebrating success is critical. And appreciating the fact that not everybody around you is the same. You know, the notion of collaboration maybe is something else that I'd encourage my younger self to think about. I think 20 years ago, I probably thought collaboration meant consensus. That to me was frustrating because I didn't see the value in gaining consensus, quite honestly. Like, we're data driven. Here's the data, make a decision, let's move on. But I think I've learned that A, collaboration does give you better outcomes because especially if you have a diverse group of individuals that you're getting input from. And B, collaboration doesn't mean consensus. Collaboration means gaining input and having the strength then to make a decision and holding yourself accountable based upon the information that you get in. And you're not going to be able to have everybody nod their head and sign off on every decision. That's okay.
I like it. So you were a lone wolf when you were younger.
Hey, some would say I'm still a lone wolf. So it's always top of mind. You always have that on your shoulder, right?
Thank you for joining us. I know, you know, obviously you have a busy schedule. So we appreciate you taking the time. And it was a wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
That was a very pleasant, unscripted type of a conversation, which is exactly how I like it. So thanks for your insightful questions. Hope you got what you were looking for. It was a pleasure.
This podcast is sponsored by Zelros. Zelros is an AI software solution for insurance to hyper-personalize the customer buying experience.
with insurance recommendations across all channels, boosting client acquisitions, cross-sell, and upsell. Thank you for tuning in to the InsureBreak podcast. Join us next month as we interview another insurance executive to gain insight on innovative practices, technology advancements, and what the future of the industry looks like. See you next month.